episode number 5 of Urban Preppers Podcast. It's the podcast dedicated to living a more self-sufficient and prepared lifestyle in the urban context. I'm Greg, I'm your host, and I really appreciate you tuning in. I would really appreciate it if any of you can leave a review of my podcast on iTunes. You know, doesn't matter if you love it or you hate it or you think you've got some feedback for me. It helps the podcast get found, and I really do appreciate the feedback. Also, you can reach me by email, loneurbanprepping@gmail.com. I would love to get feedback. For me, I'm doing this sort of as a labor of love, trying to impart what information I have, but also sort of start a conversation. I really want this to be more about a conversation and not one guy chatting into his computer microphone on a semi-regular basis. So any feedback you could give me, good, bad, indifferent, this is great information, this is worthless information, or maybe you have some ideas on subject matter that you'd like me to cover. Happy to do that. Ultimately, what I'd like to do is have these podcasts be actually a Google Hangout where we could have a number of people in the Hangout and we can discuss a topic. And it's, again, not just me rambling on about my plans or my thoughts, but get a diverse group of people talking through subject. I think it could be a lot of fun. This episode is dedicated to emergency planning and urban bug out planning. OpSec Sean from the Survival Prepping Facebook group had mentioned that he'd like to hear a podcast on this, and I think it's a great idea. You know, emergency planning is a kind of tricky subject, I think. It's because as you get deeper into a plan, you start to think through different scenarios, and all these different possibilities start to get pretty overwhelming. You start to just sort of try to plan for all these different contingencies, and I get lost. You can't plan for every contingency. And frankly, as we know, plans don't survive reality. There's an old military saying, I'm sure most of you've probably heard this, but that a plan doesn't survive the first shot fired. So that tells me that your plan needs to be a loose construct. A set of options that is flexible enough to give you the best possible options after disaster strikes. When I say a loose construct, you know, rather than having a very hard plan set in stone, you need to have a layered system of options to help you react. I also want to take a moment to address something. I am not an expert. In fact, I hate that term. The thing that I do on a daily basis to put food on the table, to make my living, I've been doing that for over 15 years, and I still will never tell someone I'm an expert. There are a lot of reasons for that, but mostly I don't like to use the term because I hear a lot of people in my industry claiming to be experts, claiming to be visionary thought leadership, and then I hear them impart, at the very least, bad advice, but sometimes it's nonsense. And so in my industry, there's a lot of people that tend to sort of claim to be an expert and really are frauds is probably not the right word, but seem a bit fraudulent in that. So I take a strong aversion to that word. Point is that, you know, that's in what I do on a daily basis, what I've been doing for 15 years. So, you know, when it comes to being prepared and living a self-sufficient lifestyle, I'm absolutely not an expert. I'm someone trying to figure this out just like you are. Maybe you have more experience at this than I do. I'm doing this because I think that by posting my ideas and thoughts, it can be a conversation, just as I mentioned. You can use this to supplement your own ideas. Maybe something I'm thinking about sparks an idea for you. That's what this is about. It's about sharing information, hopefully learning from one another. So I'm not an expert. I'm going to share my ideas and my plans and my experience, and hopefully you can think about it and helps you think through your own situation. We were talking about how no plan survives the first shot and that it needs to be a loose construct. Another thought I have is that if we start with the absolute worst case scenario and develop our plan around that, it should mean that we can easily tailor the plan to situations that are less severe. So for today's discussion, we're going to assume the worst case scenario. It's Wednesday, you and your spouse are both at work, your kids, if you have them, are at school when it happens. What is it? Maybe it's an earthquake, tornadoes in your area, wildfires, hurricanes. You know, I think of natural events that tend to happen with little or no warning. I guess it could be an EMP or a nuclear strike. I think the chances of those happening are pretty minuscule. I realize that a lot of you out there are planning with those things in mind, but be honest, if you plan for some sort of natural disaster that knocks out power and infrastructure, it's probably going to be relevant to a nuclear or an EMP strike, except for, of course, nuclear fallout, I suppose. The other key difference is that natural disasters tend to be a little bit more regionalized or localized, whereas a EMP or some other strike would be perhaps nationwide. Other than that, again, worst case scenario, little or no warning. You know, for me, it's the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake that will happen. It's just a matter of time. Talked about that in both episode 1 and 2. I'm not going to go into that anymore. But what are the components of our plan? Here's what I have, and here's what I'm building my plan around. Number one, communications. Number two, rendezvous locations. Number three, access to shelter for the immediate term. Number four, access to food and water, immediate term. Number five, security. Number six, access to information. Number seven, mid to long term of all the above, right? After the first 72 hours or maybe a couple days, and you'll hear me talk about this a lot, what is the plan? How do I have shelter, food, water, and security? And ideally, ongoing access to information. So communications are the first thing to think about. And when I think of communications, I think very specifically about knowing the status of my family. Is everyone okay? Number two, location. Where are they? This is huge because we want to know what to expect in terms of how long it's going to take you or maybe your spouse to get to wherever your rendezvous location is. You know, if you know that your spouse is 50 miles north of the city and roads are questionable, it might take her a couple days to get to you. You might have to completely scrap your meetup location or other key elements of your plan because of the situation. So knowing where everyone is can help you figure out the best place, way to meet up and continue as a family or a group. An important aspect of this is knowing your work's emergency plans, your spouse's work's emergency plans. The kids' schools will all have emergency plans. What are they? In case of an earthquake, how does the school respond and what do they do with the kids? You know, you don't want to work your way to their school only to find out that they have evacuated to some other location and you don't know what that location is. All schools will have emergency plans. They probably, I would think, have them in a publicly accessible spot. If not, talk to your teachers, the kids' teachers and administrators, and ask for the copy of the plan. I'm pretty sure that the Seattle Public Schools are actually posted online. I've looked at them. Number three, location of other family members or group members. You know, where is everyone? So that's sort of an extension of number two. Number four, next steps. This could be as simple as heading to meeting location A or, you know, on foot en route to rendezvous location B. So again, to me, ideally in the minutes, hours after an event, you are able, ideally, to understand where the members of your family are. Are they okay? Are they in good health? Are they hurt? Are they not? Where other members of the group or the family are and what everyone, you know, what the immediate next steps are. So here's another thing to really think about. Being able to communicate in the early moments or hours after a disaster is critical because it gives you peace of mind. Navigating through a city that is experiencing a disaster is going to be tough. It's going to require a lot of hard work, improvisation, and creative thinking, all of which are going to be a lot easier if you don't have to worry about the status of your group or your family, and you can just focus on getting to where this will be. You know, I know myself personally, if I'm working my way to our rendezvous location, but I don't know if my kids are safe, I don't know if my wife is okay, I'm going to be freaking out. That's all I'm going to be thinking about. And frankly, it's going to take my focus off the job at hand, and it's going to put me in danger. So being able to get status communications, even if it's just the first part of the, you know, just once, and you're now sort of, the plan is in motion and everyone's heading to meet up, could go a long way to helping you, A, have expectations on when you can expect people and not worry about them, but also peace of mind to follow your plan and to get it into action. So that's the what should be communicated, or at least what I think about in terms of what should be communicated. A bigger question is how. I lived in New York City from 1996 to 2006 and was there for two blackouts and of course, 9/11, 2001. The mood and atmosphere of the city was very different for all three of those events, which, you know, kind of goes without saying. The first blackout happened before 9/11. It was about 4 p.m. on a Thursday, I think, maybe a Friday. It was towards the end of the week. And it was like a party, man, at least for the first night. Bars in Manhattan were selling beer pretty cheaply because, you know, stuff was going to go warm, taste bad. Corner stores were giving out ice cream because it was going to melt in their coolers. I watched a guy standing in the middle of 8th and like 49th Street, or maybe it was 9th and 49th Street, standing in the middle of the intersection, beer bottle in his hand, his briefcase at his feet, directing traffic that was completely snarled due to a traffic signals being out. I saw a flatbed semi-truck loaded with people heading downtown because the subways weren't running, because the subways were all running on electricity that wasn't available. And otherwise, they would have had to walk where they were going. I mean, literally, people in suits and ties and briefcases and business attire just jam-packed on this 18-wheeler flatbed truck. It was pretty cool, but it was also like something out of you'd see out of a post-apocalyptic movie where people are sort of, you know, en masse, you know, moving from one location to another. The power came back on. I think it was out for I don't even know if it was out for 24 hours. It went out like 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and it was out either early the next morning or sometime during the night. You know, and it was a result of some sort of failure. I want to say Ohio or maybe Canada. Not that those two are necessarily right next to each other, but it's some place like that. And it was a chain of failures that happened across this huge system. Next day was a little more sobering as people were trying to get gas for the cars, cash from an ATM. You know, the city was trying to get back on its feet. And it was absolutely a day where the mayor was like, you know, stay home, don't go to work. Power might be on, but we're still sort of trying to get ourselves back together. So it turned out being like sort of a 3-day weekend for a lot of people. The second blackout was after 9/11, and the mood was way more fearful. You know, like there was something bigger afoot. But the reason I bring this up is because in all three of these events, the two blackouts and certainly 9/11, cell phones were just about useless. The lines were so jammed that it was difficult to get through. On the day of September 11, 2001, it wasn't impossible. And I actually remember getting through to my wife's family to let them know that she was safe and that we were together. We weren't married at the time. I'm not sure if that's relevant or not. And through to my family who are out of the area to pass news along that, you know, we were safe. But I got through as I was sitting in a friend's apartment watching the TV with nothing else to do. The entire city was shut down. You couldn't get on or off the island of Manhattan. Nothing was running. There were some cafes and bars and things open, but you know, the streets were the quietest and emptiest I've ever experienced in New York City. It was actually kind of spooky in a way. It was so quiet. And even people moving on the street, it was just, you know, either they were afraid, they were quiet, they were thoughtful, but it was quiet in the city. And we had nothing to do. I mean, there's nothing. We just sat in an apartment and watched the news, trying to understand what was going on and what had happened. So I was just sitting in the apartment hitting redial, and I finally got through enough to basically say, hey, we're okay. Don't worry about us. We'll be in touch soon, you know? So cell phones, almost useless. You might not be able to. In fact, you shouldn't plan on being able to communicate. I realize the first part of this discussion was about communication and about how that brings peace of mind. I think you should try, but you can't plan on it. But there are some options you might go through to try, you know, or to try to communicate to either family out of the area or maybe your own direct family or group members to let them know you're okay and what your status is. In the past, during different situations, text messages have been more successful than voice at getting through. Text might actually be preferred as it's shortened to the point, and if there's a lot going on, you know, you can rip off a quick text message someone can hopefully receive it and you can move on. You know, think, yeah, okay, headed to location A, see you soon. You know, kids safe, I'm safe, meeting you, location B, love you. Email. Smartphones with email capabilities are pretty common. In fact, I think they're probably in the majority nowadays. And the way that data is transmitted is different than voice traditionally. So it might, an email might have a better chance of getting through. Now, the other side of this is that it may not because of the number of people using data services to communicate. For example, it was a few years ago before the iPhone was available on other carriers other than AT&T, and cities like San Francisco and New York City had such a high concentration of iPhones, people using those data services, that it was almost impossible to use your phone on those markets. It was very difficult to get a signal and drop calls. So, you know, nowadays you have even more iPhones, you have more Android phones, more people using data. That may make it even harder to get through. Social sites. You might try posting to a social site like Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Again, I'm not saying your internet's going to be up if you don't have any power for your wireless network at home. You probably don't. If you have, you know, access to, again, data network through your cell phone, maybe you can get through to a social site. Again, a data network is, you know, data is data. So email, social site, whatever, may not make a difference, but it's things to try. Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, you know, safe here in Seattle after quake. Please pass along to Renee if possible. What isn't clear to me, because I'm, again, no expert, is if the carriers still use both phone networks and data networks to transmit both phone and data. For instance, I know that a data network can transmit anything, voice, text, video, pictures. It just treats data as data. But a traditional voice network can only transmit voice. What I don't know is if any of the carriers still run both, so they're, you know, they may use your voice network for voice and data network for data, or just maybe sometimes it's both, or, you know, using voice on data, and what markets this might even be possible in. My point in all of that is that, you know, if you live in New York and you happen to have a cell plan that they're using a voice network, and everyone's on their smartphones trying to send email, text, and social status, voice may have an easier time getting through because all the data networks are clogged up. I have no idea. Something to think about. Maybe something to understand in your area, or your network carrier, and understand what kind of, how they transmit voice, how they transmit data, that sort of thing. People out of the area. I don't know why, but sometimes during a time when phones and data lines are jammed up, reaching someone out of the area is actually easier than someone local. My story of 9/11, my wife's parents lived in Seattle. We were in New York City. My family was in Dallas. And as I was able to reach people outside of the area, but I was not able to reach anyone in the area. So part of our plan is an out-of-area contact that the entire family has. And that person knows that they're going to be the designated hub of communications. That person is willing and able to be the person to relay messages from others in your family or your group. So you've checked in, you know the status of your family, and now it's time to execute the next steps of your plan. For me personally, rendezvous location is my number one priority. Communication and knowing the status of everyone is going to be really key to me having a proactive and creative mindset as I work to get to my family. But being able to get to my family is my priority. I have two small kids, and my wife's business frequently takes her to different parts of the city. She's never in one location. So there's a really good chance that we're not going to be together when something big happens. So my first goal is to get everyone together. Because communications may not be possible, you should have a couple of pre-planned rendezvous locations. Again, no plan survives the first shot fired, but having some options should make things easier. And as well as some predetermined scenarios that sort of say location A, location B, location C, so forth. For me, our first choice is our house. This is where my supplies are. And not only that, our house is really close to my daughter's school, and likely on the way to my son's school from anywhere my wife or I are going to be. My wife tends to do a lot of work north of the city. I tend to be either in our house or working north or east. Our kid's school is south of where we are. So we're most likely going to be moving right past our house to go get my son. So that's our number one location. You know, if it is safe for us to be on our block or near our house, I would rather meet there to make sure that there, even if it's our house isn't habitable, there might be some salvageable supplies. So that's our plan A. What's your plan A? What priorities drive that location? Is it your house? Is it someplace else? Where are you likely to be? Where are you during the week? Where's your wife? Where are your kids? Where are your other group members? Think through sort of some of the contingencies on choosing your plan A. Now, plan B, we have family in the area, but for a variety of reasons, our plan B is not going to be a family member's house. Seattle has set up emergency communications hubs in neighborhoods around the city. These hubs are set up in churches, parks, other public places, and they've been chosen in advance by that neighborhood's volunteers. The hubs are meant to allow neighbors to meet needs and share resources during an emergency because the police and fire aren't going to be able to respond. So this is sort of a quasi-location where people are going to be gathering to help each other out, to get access to information, that sort of thing. We have a hub just blocks away from our house, and in fact, it's right across the street from my daughter's school. So this is a natural place for us to not only meet, but perhaps, you know, hole up for a short period of time as we try to understand what might be going on, you know, the extent of the situation. Ideally, there's some way to get access to information there. Because it's a sort of quasi-emergency location, there may be some means to gather information. It might seem odd that this is our plan B, but we do have family in the area, but if the roads are bad and the city is a mess, I would rather have my wife and possibly our kids there, close to our house, amongst sort of neighbors and potentially around other sort of people concerned about keeping the area safe, while I work my way to them, because we don't know what other families' locations shape are going to be in. And I want them on the road, traveling from location to location, be it by car or on foot, as little as humanly possible until I can be with them. I just want them safe and locked in, safe and sound until I can get there. Our plan C, you know, we have family in the area. One of Renee's brothers lives about a mile away, and that's our plan C. The problem is that if our house is destroyed, his might be as well. If it isn't, it's certainly a good option for shelter. Or maybe it's, you know, plan B, Renee's at the emergency, you know, park. But now it's getting dark. It's getting late. I'm nowhere to be found. You know, okay, get to your brother's house, get indoors, get shelter, get safe, and I'll work my way there. When you're planning your rendezvous locations, you need to take into consideration that, you know, they may be destroyed or inaccessible. So what are the backup locations? I'm of the belief that in the first 72 hours, being around others and having access to information are probably a good thing. I believe to a certain degree, and we'll talk about this a bit more later, that there is some measure of security in crowds and groups. That's not always absolute, and crowds can go bad. But in general, being around people is probably going to be a good thing, at least initially. Churches, libraries, schools, community centers, even fire and police stations, these are all good ideas for rendezvous locations. There's going to be others that might be meeting there as well. There might be of access to some sort of information if it's some sort of official place. Certainly if it's a police or fire station, there may be a bit more information if anyone's there. You know, these are also places that might end up being sort of mob scenes and crazy and chaotic, and you have to use your best judgment. But, you know, you got to figure out some options to meet where people are going to be safe and easy to get to, and that makes sense for you in terms of your location. You know, where you're rendezvousing isn't necessarily where you're going to stay. It's simply a place where you can meet with your family or group and determine what your next steps are. I'm sure I'm missing some options for rendezvous locations, but those are some good ones that I think about. Before we move on, I want to go talk a bit about getting from wherever you are when disaster strikes to your rendezvous location, specifically on foot. You know, most modern American cities are not built with the pedestrian in mind. They're built for cars and easy access to businesses and retail with wide roads and lots of access points. But in a crisis situation, roads may be out or closed by emergency services. Traffic might be so bad that you're sitting in your car, inching along for hours at a time while you burn gas. Let me give you an example. A couple of years ago, there was a snowstorm in Seattle. It wasn't a surprise. Everyone knew it was coming. I was at the office where I worked at the time, and I decided to cut out early. I didn't have any work that I absolutely needed to get done, and you know, the relationship I had both with my boss and the people that ran the company, you know, there was this atmosphere of, you know, if you don't have to be in the office or if you need to cut out early for something that you need to do or whatever, that was okay. You know, it was a very sort of adult environment for that kind of thing. So I cut out to you know, basically manage what little I needed to manage for my home office. So the snowstorm starts in the late afternoon, and the roads are snarled and backed up, and hundreds, if not thousands of people were essentially trapped on the road for hours at a time. One guy in my office spent 13 hours moving about 20 miles to his home. I mean, this was a little snowstorm that everyone knew was coming. So my point is that for a number of really good reasons, you might just have to get out and walk. If you have an EDC kit or even your 72-hour bag in your car, it's great, man. Strap it on and start humping. There are a couple of ideas, thoughts that I want to throw out to the group. So not too long ago, I saw an episode of Doomsday Preppers that focused on people working to bug out of New York City. It was actually a pretty interesting episode and and far more sort of interesting and informative than a lot of those shows. Most of them, I'm starting to get to a point where I can't even watch them anymore. In fact, I'm already there, frankly. But I digress. In one of the scenarios, was a young woman who was working with a security expert, and they were walking through Central Park at night. The security expert staged an attack to help her understand how she needed to be aware and on guard. But what I'm thinking is, why the hell would you walk through Central Park at night? This is just asking for trouble, if you ask me. So let's be clear. New York City is nowhere near the dangerous city it once was prior to Rudy Giuliani. Not even close. Another point is that, you know, Central Park is huge. It stretches from the southern end of Harlem around 125th Street all the way down to Midtown, like 59th Street. Harlem used to be an area that was not necessarily safe in a lot of ways, but even that's changed a lot. I haven't lived there in almost 10 years, but when I was there, a lot of people were moving up there because you could still get reasonably priced, by New York standards anyway, apartments. It was already in transition from being someplace you didn't go if you weren't from that neighborhood to someplace that was reasonably safe. But all that aside, in a city, in an urban environment, people, crowds, can and do provide some measure of safety. You are far more at risk by yourself, all alone, in a dark place than weaving through crowded sidewalks. I realize that crowds can turn very ugly and that you don't want to get caught in the middle of a riot, but I also believe that the vast majority of people, regardless of where they live, just want to live their life, go to work, raise their families, have some happiness. In a lot of situations, this works in your favor. Being surrounded by other people going about their days is not a good environment for crime. I'm not saying it can or won't happen, but given the choice between sneaking through Central Park or going 20 blocks out of my way, but traveling next to hundreds or thousands of others working their way home brings a measure of safety. I believe. I mean, this is my personal opinion. I think this is true for every city that I've ever lived in. All the cities, you know, all cities have those neighborhoods that you just don't want to walk through unless you're looking for drugs or trouble of some sort. But aside from those, you are in general better off part of a crowd than on your own and potentially vulnerable. The second point I want to raise is about the idea of the gray man. I know that all of you know the concept. It essentially means don't stand out, blend in, be a faceless person in the crowd. I struggle with this sometimes. You know, there's a brand of cargo pants that I love. I own like 5 pairs of them and I wear them constantly. When you combine that with my baseball hat and my Merrell shoes, I start to look like Captain Tactical wannabe. I know this. I mean, my friends and family make fun of me, but you know, I don't care. I'm comfortable. So think about how well you blend into the crowd. Think about your EDC or your 72-hour bag. How well does that blend into the crowd? I can say from personal experience that in New York City, it's almost impossible to stick out. Walking the streets of New York City, you see so many odd and strange things on a daily basis that you become numb to it. I remember an incident when I first moved to New York City. I was walking down the street, and there was this woman who was essentially naked. I mean, she was skin and bones and completely naked except for like a torn, tattered blanket. And she was sprawled out on this thing of cardboard, and she was crying and holding her hand out for money or help. I couldn't believe it. I was horrified. It was the most shocking thing that I'd ever seen. And people were just walking by in droves. I mean, they're just walking by ignoring her. Now, to my eternal shame, I walked by as well. But as I walked by, there was this family, probably tourists, had stopped by to help her. They stopped and bent down to help her and see what they could do. My point is that people in New York City can get numb to things. So if you're humping your 22-hour kit down Madison Avenue, you're probably not going to stand out too much, except for, you know, to people who might be looking for a target. Now, as a postscript to my story about the woman, this happened a few blocks from my sister and brother-in-law's apartment at the time. And I'd actually mentioned the incident to my brother-in-law because I was actually on the way to their house, I think, at the time, and I was freaked out. It was really, really just shocked me. And what he told me was that he sees her every day, and that on a couple occasions he'd seen her show up to that location fully dressed and then strip down and wrap herself in that blanket and sort of start the show. Now, that sounds incredible to me, but I don't think my brother-in-law was lying either. So I just throw that out there as... because, you know, even in a place like New York City, something like that's pretty crazy. I mean, it's not Calcutta, India, for Christ's sake. So, you know, there is for, you know, for all the people I saw begging on the street or looking for money or handouts or, you know, washing windows or something, trying to get, you know, get by, that was the most extreme thing I'd ever seen. And, you know, according to my brother-in-law, it was an act. It wasn't even a real situation. So, but I digress quite a bit. The point is, don't isolate yourself if you can help it. And unless you see the crowd as becoming dangerous and ugly, you know, blend in. Move through an area like an invisible man or woman. Remember, your goal is to get to where you're headed. So you've got your communications plan, you've rendezvoused with your group and family, and now it's time to determine what happens next. This is the area that becomes really difficult to plan, at least for me. I think there's, you know, all these different scenarios depending on what's going on and how bad things are. I mean, let's look at the worst case. Your house is destroyed, or at least it's uninhabitable. The roads and infrastructure are damaged to the point that travel is going to be very difficult and slow going. What's the plan? If you have a retreat location that is stocked and ready to go, well, you know, now's the time to bug out, right? And even if you have to go there by foot. But what about those of us who don't have a retreat? And I think it's probably the majority of us. I mean, maybe it's not within the prepping community, but if the numbers of people prepping or anything like the rest of the world, you know, society, the number of people who are actually have some you know, retreat location they can head out to is probably you know, the minority. Communications are either down or severely compromised. The roads and infrastructure are questionable. You know, do you strike out for a family or friend's house only to find out that it was destroyed? You know, you could end up moving from one location to another with family and friends in tow, and all you accomplish is that everyone is tired and no better off when they started to travel. This is probably going to sound controversial, but I think my plan is to stay put and find a relatively safe spot until I can truly understand what's going on. For example, the reason our B option for rendezvous is the communications hub is because if needed, we can strike a tent there and sit tight for a day or two as things become a bit more clear as to exactly what's going on, how bad everything is, what areas are, you know, really destroyed or not. Not only that, but I'm only a few blocks away from my house, and I probably make some runs to salvage some supplies or maybe use the basement as a shelter, even though the rest of the house is not habitable. If my street is inaccessible right after the disaster, that doesn't mean it'll stay that way. Sitting tight might give us access to shelter and our supplies. But let's assume that the house is destroyed and there's nothing to be salvaged or accessed. As we said, communications are down, the roads and especially the bridges are questionable. A 6 or 11 mile journey, distances to relatives' houses, might take hours or even days, and we don't know how bad things are out there. Conversely, I can pitch our family-sized tent in a park that is being used as a communications hub in our neighborhood. There are other people there, which can be a form of security, as I talked about. We can sit tight for a day or two and then decide what to do based on what we learn. And that's, you know, that's part of my plan. You may think that sounds crazy, but to me, because as you get sort of, I said, so deep into a situation, so many different options, I don't know how else to sort of plan for all these different contingencies. And maybe that's my shortcoming, and maybe, you know, that's why I shouldn't be talking about planning. But again, I'm not an expert. I'm just sharing sort of some of my thoughts on the subject. So how and where are you going to shelter for that first 24 to 48 hours? More importantly, what do you always have with you in the case, you know, in your car, in case you get caught out from your home and lose access to your supplies? I always have my EDC get home backpack with me, even if I'm on foot. In my truck, I have a 72-hour bag because I don't know when I'm going to need it, and I can't count on being at home, having access to it when disaster strikes. Here's another idea that comes to me that completely, you know, could potentially solve both access to supplies and shelter. You know, I've heard people talk about storage units for, you know, supplies caches. And I've heard some discussion about whether or not they're a good idea or not. But a storage unit with 24-hour access could be not only a cache of supplies you can get access to, but it could be a shelter. You know, if your home is destroyed, you know, you could hole up in there for a day or two with your family until you figure out what's going on. We're not talking about riding out or not talking about staying there full time. We're talking about riding out the first 24 to 72 hours in order to better understand the situation and what your next step should be. In a long-term situation where people are going on weeks without reliable access to food, power, and water, a storage unit could definitely be a prime target for people looking for supplies. But in the first couple of days, you know, I don't think so. People are going to be cleaning out the local stores and honing, you know, hoping for government relief. So, you know, that argument that I hear that, you know, a storage unit could be the first kind of place or a typical place where people try to ransack for supplies. Yeah, I get that. But I don't think in the first hours, even a couple days after something bad happens. So my plan involves pitching a tent or a few tarps in a park. But what do you do if you don't have access to a park or if it's winter? I go back to my earlier question of what do you have in your vehicle is stored in at least one backup location to allow you to stay warm and dry and out of the elements. I think we all agree that checking into some FEMA or some other official shelter where we have to surrender our weapons or just in, you know, some sort of holding camp is an awful idea. But what are your options? You need to think through what your options are for your plan. What about security? Does your state allow concealed carry? Do you carry? Do you carry every day? Do you train and practice and hone your skills? Do you have ammo in your EDC or your 72-hour kit? Do you have weapons stored in your supplies cache, your storage unit? You know, talking a little bit about weapons, you know, pistols versus rifles, shotguns, there's going to be very few scenarios where you're going to be able to walk around with a shotgun or rifle without raising the attention of law enforcement. And in a situation where they have more than they can handle, they're not going to give you benefit of the doubt. You know, they got more than they can handle. They can't keep up. And then they get a report of somebody walking around with a rifle in their hands. They're probably going to take your rifle and throw you, you know, in jail or arrest you, regardless of the trouble they may get into after the fact, because it's a simple solution to a problem that they don't have time to deal with. My own personal opinion. I'm not a law enforcement officer, never have been, they've never talked to anyone about this. That's my gut reaction. So, but the bottom line is, you know, what are you doing about your own security? At least for moving around, I carry and I have backup ammo in my ADC. You know, there's a great line from the first Die Hard movie with Bruce Willis. It's one of my favorite lines. I've always laughed about it. And frankly, it's become kind of like part of my life. You know, Officer John McClane, Bruce Willis is, you know, talking by a walkie-talkie or radio to these cops on the ground. And there's the patrol cop who's sort of his buddy on the ground, helping him through things. And then this commanding officer who's, you know, arrogant, kind of a twit, shows up and grabs the radio and is talking to Bruce Willis and being a jerk. And finally, Bruce Willis says, you know, you're either part of the problem or you're part of the solution. You know, quit being part of the effing problem. Put the other guy on. And I just, to me, life can be that simple sometimes. You're either part of the problem or part of the solution. Quit being part of the problem. And for me, when it comes to my own security and some other things, I'm not going to be part of the problem. I'm going to not only take the steps that I need to take to keep my family secure, but I'm going to train, I'm going to practice, I'm going to be ready. Just, I think in this community, very few people have to be told that they should have access to weapons and training, but it's something that I can't talk about this subject without touching on. So another aspect of sort of my preparedness plan, or my thinking, as at least as it relates to preparedness, is access to information. In a situation where you have something that is statewide or maybe even a regional event, the authorities are going to be overwhelmed, but there might be access to info on the radio or TV because of news organizations that are not from the area, or they're broadcasting the news for people outside of the area. So your ability to access information with which to plan is going to be critical. The reality of prepping in an urban situation is that we may have some really lousy options for shelter and access to food, especially in the long term. But with access to information, you can figure out if you need to try to make your way out of the area, or if you can ride out the situation where you are. At least that's the hope. Back to your EDC or your car emergency kit. What do you have for a radio? Do you have enough batteries? Do you have an alternative source of electricity? Do you have the ability to transmit as well as receive? Ham radios are a topic that comes up a lot in this community, and they just sound like an awesome option. It's certainly in my list of things that I want to get done, is get my license, get a ham radio, start understanding how to use it. I just think it's awesome, and to have the ability to tune into what's going on could be really cool, especially if you could transmit and talk to someone maybe out of the area who has access to electricity and news radio and might have more information than you do. But at the very least, a small wind-up emergency radio, where you could listen in on the news or maybe emergency announcements or what's going on, could make the difference for you in terms of heading deeper into trouble or heading out of trouble. Lastly, on the list of priorities is the idea of mid to long-term access to shelter, food, water, security, etc. And yeah, I gotta say that at this point, in the worst-case scenario, home destroyed, supplies destroyed, the situation is as dire as it may be months before things are even close to being back to normal. I have to say that I think my situation, and again, I don't necessarily have this as part of my plan, but our situation may be that we need to get out of the area. We need to leave the area, and if that's the case, it'll be head south to Texas, where my folks have a ranch. Otherwise, the room, because otherwise, I find myself sort of, sitting in some camp, some FEMA organization, some emergency shelter, waiting out government handouts, somebody else telling me what to do. I just in one of those sort of completely dire situations where it's going to be months until things go back to normal, if they ever do at all. I think that will be what we'll have to resort to. Now, how do I get down to Texas from Seattle? That's going to be a different story entirely. I mean, that sounds like a book. If walking all the way from Texas to or far from Seattle to Texas just sounds like a crazy idea. And frankly, what you might have to do is sort of walk or struggle your way out of the immediate area, and then you might quickly, or not quickly, but soon find your way to an area that isn't necessarily destroyed and has access and infrastructure, where you might rent a car, you might jump on a bus, you might buy a car, you might buy some bicycles. And just to get further out of the situation and further into an area that maybe isn't as devastated and as destroyed. And that brings me to the last point I'd like to talk about in terms of emergency planning, and that's cash and money. One of the things that people talk about a lot when we think about bad stuff happening is financial downturn, the dollar being worthless, rampant inflation, unemployment, having your paper money be almost meaningless. And there are a lot of very realistic scenarios where I can see that happening. And I definitely think of that as is something that I see as a likely probability down the road. But I also think that that's not something that's going to happen overnight. And nor is the dollar or the cash you have in your pocket going to lose all its value overnight in the face of some disaster. Now, a couple weeks later, it may. And certainly the prices for things that are considered needed or important, water, food, maybe even things like transportation, are going to go up as people try to take advantage of the situation. But the value of your dollar is not going to overnight crash and burn in a situation like this. How much money do you have on hand? How much money do you carry in your EDC bag? How much money do you carry in your emergency kit in your car? Your ability, again, worst case scenario, you can't get into your house. You can't get into your safe. Everything that you had, except for what was on your back or maybe in your car, is gone. What kind of access to money do you have, or what cash do you have, to get your family out of the area? Whether it's to relative safely, a couple hundred miles away or 100 miles away, or is it, to get far enough out so then you can maybe jump on a bus and work your way to a distant relative or friend's house, like I plan to do with Texas. Again, I think that a lot of us have our stash of food and supplies and, water and weapons, and it's in our home or maybe our retreat location. But what we forget about is the likelihood that something can happen when we're not at home. And so at that point, everything on our back or everything in our car is what we've got. What do you guys carry? What do you have with you that's going to see you through not just 72 hours, but maybe a lot longer of that in the worst case scenario? So on that note, I'm going to start to sort of wrap up here. Those are my thoughts on emergency planning. And as you can tell, as you get further down sort of into the plan, my plan is not really a plan, but rather a set of organized thoughts on some options or things that we might try to do. For me, what we do have a plan, sort of not set in stone, but firm, is this idea of how do we find one another? How do we communicate? Where we might find some immediate shelter, at least in the first 72 hours. But after that, depending on the situation, is when I'm going to start calling audibles and figure out what's the best answer for my family. Because I think the as I've said, the number of different scenarios is so many that I get confused even trying to think about how to plan them out, and I don't think that makes sense. So rather, I'm going to try to set myself in a situation where, worst case scenario, I have access to some things that'll see us through, and then we'll try to make good decisions and remain safe and try to get ourselves out of that, sort of the trouble area, if you will. Communications, status, locations, next step, rendezvous with family and group members, immediate shelter, access to food and water for the immediate term, security, access to information, and then what you're going to do about the long term. Those are the things for me that, or at least, and if it's not everything, it's a good start to build your plan around. So with that, I really hope you've enjoyed this episode. It was a difficult one for me to put together because, again, like I said, there's just so much I don't know. I'd love it to be a starting point for ongoing conversation. I'd love to hear from you guys. I'd love to, maybe do some additional podcasts or maybe a Google Hangout where we could talk about it more. And, maybe your feedback is, man, you're nuts. You don't have any idea what you're talking about, and here's why. I'd love to have that conversation and love to hear from people who have very, very different ideas on their emergency or bug out planning and how those ideas might be shared and adapted across other people's situations. This was episode number 5 of Urban Prepping Podcast, the podcast dedicated to living a more self-sufficient and prepared lifestyle in the urban context. Thanks again for joining, and I'll see you soon.